T. Lobsang Rampa Living with the Lama. Living with the Lama, originally published in 1964, a book telepathically dictated by one of Dr. Rampa's many cats, Fifi Grey Whiskers. Animals are not dumb the creatures as many humans think. We are ones who are dumb in comparison to all animals. All animals can communicate via telepathy. Humans have this ability blocked due to their devious nature. Fifi tell of her life before meeting Dr. Rampa and their journeys they took together. It is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. Living with the Lama by Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers, PSC, translated from the Siamese cat language by T. Lobsang Rampa, illustrated by Sheila M. Rouse. To MA, who nurses us when we are sick, looks after us when we need it, and loves us all the time. Forward, you've gone off your head, thief, said the Lama. Who will believe that you wrote a book? He smiled down at me and rubbed under my chin in just the way I liked best before he left the room on some business. I sat and pondered. Why should I not write a book? I thought. True that I am a cat, but not an ordinary cat. Oh dear. No. I am a Siamese cat who has traveled far and seen much. Seen? Well, of course, I am quite blind now, and have to rely on the Lama and the Lady Kaa to tell me of the present scene, but I have my memories. Of course I am old, very old indeed, and not a little infirm, but is that not good reason why I should put on paper the events of my life, while I am able? Here, then, is my version of living with the Lama, and the happiest days of my life, days of sunshine after a lifetime of shadows. Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers. Chapter 1. Mother-to-be was shrieking her head off. I want a Tom, she yelled, a nice strong Tom. The noise, the people said, was terrible. But then, Mother was renowned for her loud calling voice. At her insistent demand, all the best catteries in Paris were combed for a suitable Siamese Tom with the necessary pedigree. Shriller and louder grew Mother-to-be's voice. More and more distraught grew the people as they turned with renewed strength to the search. At last a very presentable candidate was found, and he and Mother-to-be were formally introduced. From that meeting, in course of time, I appeared, and I alone was allowed to live. My brothers and sisters were drowned. Mother and I lived with an old French family who had a spacious estate on the outskirts of Paris. The man was a diplomat of high rank who journeyed to the city most days of the week. Often he would not return at night but would stay in the city with his mistress. The woman who lived with us, me, diplomat, was a very hard woman, shallow and dissatisfied. We cats were not persons to her, as we are to the Lama, but just things to be shown off at tea parties. Mother had a glorious figure, with the blackest of black faces and a tail that stood straight up. She had won many, many prizes. One day, before I was properly weaned, she sang a song rather more loudly than usual. Me. Diplomat flew into a tantrum and called the gardener. Pierre, she shouted, take her to the pond instantly, I cannot bear the noise. Pierre, an undersized, sallow-faced little Frenchman who hated us because we sometimes helped him with the gardening by inspecting plant roots to see if they were growing, scooped up my beautiful mother and put her into a dirty old potato sack and they marched off into the distance. That night, lonely and afraid, I cried myself to sleep in a cold outhouse where me, diplomat, would not be disturbed by my lamentations. I tossed restlessly, feverishly, on my cold bed of old Paris newspapers thrown on the concrete floor. Pangs of hunger racked my small frame and I wondered how I would manage. As the first streaks of dawn reluctantly struggled through the cobweb-covered windows of the outhouse, I started with apprehension as heavy footsteps clattered up the path, hesitated at the door, then pushed it open and entered. Ah! I thought in relief, it is only Madame Albertine, the housekeeper. Creaking and gasping, she lowered her massive frame to the floor, dipped a gigantic finger into a bowl of warm milk and gently persuaded me to drink. For days I walked in the shadow of sorrow, grieving for my murdered mother, murdered solely because of her glorious singing voice. For days I felt not the warmth of the sun, nor thrilled to the sound of a well-loved voice. I hungered and thirsted, and depended wholly upon the good offices of Madame Albertine. Without her I should have starved to death, for I was then too young to eat unaided. The days dragged on, and became weeks. I learned to fend for myself, but the hardships of my early life left me with an impaired constitution. The estate was huge, and I often wandered about, keeping away from people, and their clumsy, unguided feet. The trees were my favorites. I climbed them and stretched at length along a friendly bough, basking in the sun. The trees whispered to me, telling me of the happier days to come in the evening of my life. Then I understood them not, but trusted, and kept the words of the trees ever before me, even in the darkest moments. One morning I awakened with strange, ill-defined longings. I uttered a yelp of interrogation which, unfortunately, me, diplomat heard. Pierre. She called, "Fetch a tomcat, any tomcat will do to break her in." Later in the day I was seized and thrown roughly into a wooden box. Almost before I was aware of anyone being present, a disreputable old tomcat leapt upon my back. Mother had had no opportunity to tell me much about the facts of life, so I was not prepared for what followed. The battered old tomcat leapt upon me, and I felt a shocking blow. For a moment I thought that one of the people had kicked me. There was a blinding flash of pain, and I felt something tear. I shrieked in agony and terror and raked fiercely at the old tom. Blood spattered from one of his ears and his yelling voice added to mine. Like a flash of lightning the box top was ripped off and startled eyes peered in. I leapt out. As I escaped I saw the old tom, spitting and snarling, jump straight at Pierre, who tumbled over backwards at the feet of me. Diplomat. Streaking across a lawn I made for the shelter of a friendly apple tree. Scrambling up the welcoming trunk, I reached a well-loved limb and lay at full length, panting. The leaves rustled in the breeze and gently caressed me. Branches swayed and creaked and slowly lulled me into the sleep of exhaustion. For the rest of the day and the whole of the night I lay upon the branch, hungry, afraid and sick, wondering why humans were so savage, so uncaring of the feelings of little animals who were utterly dependent upon them. The night was cold, and a light drizzle blew over from the city of Paris. I was soaked, and shivering, yet was terrified to descend and seek shelter. The cold light of early morning slowly gave way to the dull greyness of an overcast day. Leaden clouds scudded across the lowering sky. Occasionally there was a spatter of rain. About mid-morning a familiar figure hove in sight from the direction of the house. Madame Albertine, waddling heavily, and clucking sympathetically, approached the tree, peering short-sightedly. I called weakly to her and she reached her hand towards me. "Ah, my poor little Fifi, come to me quickly for I have your food." I slid backwards along the branch and climbed slowly down the trunk. She knelt in the grass beside me, stroking me as I drank the milk and ate the meat which she had brought. With my meal finished, I rubbed gratefully against her, knowing that she did not speak my language, and I did not speak French, although I fully understood it. Lifting me to her broad shoulder, she carried me to the house and took me to her room. I looked about me in wide-eyed amazement and interest. This was a new room to me and I thought how very suitable the furnishings would be for stretching one's Klaus. With me still upon her shoulder, Madame Albertine moved heavily to a wide window seat, and looked out. She exclaimed, exhaling gustily, "The pity of it, amid all this beauty there is so much cruelty." She lifted me to her very ample lap and gazed into my face as she said, "My poor, beautiful little Fifi, me. Is a hard and cruel woman, a social climber if ever there was one. To her you are just a toy to be shown off, to me you are one of the good God's own creatures. But you will not understand what I am saying, little cat." I purred to show that I did, and licked her hands. She patted me and said, "Oh, such love and affection going to waste, you will make a good mother, little Fifi." As I curled more comfortably on her lap I glanced out of the window. The view was so interesting that I had to get up and press my nose to the glass in order to obtain a better view. Teen smiled fondly at me as she playfully pulled my tail, but the view engaged my whole attention. She turned and rolled to her knees with a thud. Together we looked out of the window, cheek to cheek. Below us the well-kept lawns looked like a smooth green carpet fringed by an avenue of stately poplar trees. Curving gently towards the left, the smooth greyness of the drive stretched away to the distant road from whence came the muted roar of traffic surging to and from the great metropolis. My old friend the apple tree stood lonely and erect by the side of a small artificial lake, the surface of which, reflecting the dull greyness of the sky, took upon itself the sheen of old lead. Around the water's edge a sparse fringe of reeds grew, reminding me of the fringe of hair on the head of the old cure who came to see Leduc, me's husband. I gazed again at the pond, and thought of my poor mother who had been done to death there, and how many others. I wondered and looked suddenly at me and said, "Why, my little Fifi, you are crying, I think. Yes, you have shed it here. It is a cruel, cruel world, little Fifi. Cruel for all of us." Suddenly, in the distance, little black specks which I knew to be cars turned into the drive and came speeding up to the house to halt in a flurry of dust and a squeal of tires. A bell jangled furiously, causing my fur to stand up and my tail to fluff, and picked up a black thing which I knew was called the telephone, and I heard me's shrill voice pouring agitatedly from it, "Albertine, Albertine, why do you not attend to your duties? Why do I pay you? I am so charitable that I keep you. Come instantly, for we have visitors. You must not laze so, Albertine." The voice clicked off, and Madame Albertine sighed with frustration. "That the war has brought me to this. Now I work for 16 hours a day for a mere pittance. You rest, little Fifi, and here is a box of earth." Sighing again, she patted me once more and walked out of the room. I heard the stairs creaking beneath her weight. Then, silence. The stone terrace beneath my window was swarming with people. It was bowing and being so subservient that I knew there were important persons. Little tables appeared as if by magic, were covered with fine white cloths. I used newspapers, Le Paris Soir, as my tablecloth, and servants carried out food and drink in ample profusion. I turned away to curl up when a sudden thought made my tail fluff in alarm. I had overlooked the most elementary precaution. I had forgotten the first thing my mother taught me: always investigate a strange room, Fifi, she had said. Go over everything thoroughly, check all escape routes. Be wary of the unusual, the unexpected. Never, never rest until you know the room. Guiltily I rose to my feet, sniffed the air, and decided how to proceed. I would take the left wall first and work my way round. Dropping to the floor, I peered beneath the window seat, sniffing for anything unusual, getting to know the layout, the dangers and the advantages. The wallpaper was flowery and faded. Big yellow flowers on a purple background. Tall chairs, spotlessly clean but with the red velvet seating faded. The undersides of the chairs and tables were clean and free from cobwebs. Cats, you know, see the underside of things, not the top, and humans would not recognize things from our viewpoint. A tall boy stood against one wall and I edged into the center of the room so as to decide how to get to the top. A quick calculation showed me that I could leap from a chair to the table. Oh, how slippery it was, and reach the top of the tall boy. For a time I sat there, washing my face and ears as I thought things over. Casually I glanced behind me and almost fell over in startled alarm. A Siamese cat was looking at me. Evidently I had disturbed her while she was washing. Strange, I thought. I did not expect to find a cat here. And must be keeping it secret. I will just say hello. I moved towards her, and she, seemingly having the same idea, moved to me. We stopped with some sort of a window between us. Remarkable, I mused. How can this be? Cautiously, anticipating a trick, I peered around the back of the window. There was no one there. Amazingly, every move I made she copied. It dawned upon me, this was a mirror, a strange device mother had told me about. Certainly it was the first I had seen, because this was my first visit inside the house. It was very particular, and cats were not permitted inside the house unless she wanted to show us off. I so far had been spared that indignity. Still, I muttered to myself, I must get on with my investigation. The mirror can wait. Across the room I saw a large metal structure with brass knobs at each corner, and the whole space between the knobs covered in cloth. Hastily I leapt from the tall boy to the table, skidding a little on the high polish, and jumped straight on to the cloth-covered metal structure. landed in the middle, and to my horror the thing threw me up into the air. As I landed again I started to run while I decided what to do next. For a few moments I sat in the center of the carpet, a red and blue swirly design which, although spotlessly clean, had seen much better days elsewhere. It appeared to be just right for stretching Klaus, so I gave a few tentative tugs at it and it seemed to help me to think more clearly. That huge structure was a bed. My bed was of old newspapers thrown on the concrete floor of an outhouse. Madame Albertine had some old cloth thrown over a sort of iron frame. Purring with pleasure that I had solved the mysterious matter, I walked toward it and examined the underside with vast interest. Immense springs, covered by what was obviously a tremendous sack, or split sack, bore the weight of the clothes piled upon it. I could clearly discern where Madame Albertine's heavy body had distorted some of the springs and caused them to sag. In a spirit of scientific investigation, I poked at a hanging corner of striped material at the far side near the wall. To my incredulous horror, feathers fluttered out. "Great tomcats," I exclaimed. "She keeps dead birds here. No wonder she is so big. She must eat them in the night." A few more cursory sniffs around, and I had exhausted all the possibilities of the bed. Peering around, wondering where to look next, I saw an open door, half a dozen leaps, and I cautiously crouched by a doorpost and edged forward so that one eye could get a first glimpse. At first sight the picture was so strange that I could not comprehend what I was seeing. Shiny stuff on the floor in a black and white pattern. Against one wall an immense horse trough. I knew about them. We had them near the stables. While against another wall, on a wooden platform, was the largest porcelain cup that I had ever imagined. It rested on the wooden platform and had a white wooden lid. My eyes grew rounder and rounder, and I had to sit and scratch my right ear while I thought it over. "Who would drink out of a thing this size?" I wondered. Just then I heard the sound of Madame Albertine climbing the creaking stairs, barely stopping to see that my vibracy was brushed back tidily. I rushed to the door to greet her. At my shouts of joy she beamed and said, "Ah, I have robbed the best from the table for you. The cream, and the best of the frog legs, they are for you. Those pigs are stuffing away, for they make me sick." Stooping, she placed the dishes, real dishes, right in front of me. But I had no time for food yet. I had to tell her how much I loved her. I roared with purrs as she swept me up to her ample bosom. Slept at the foot of Madame Albertine's bed. Snuggled up on the immense coverlet I was more comfortable than at any time since my mother was taken from me. My education raced ahead. I discovered the purpose of the horse trough and that which in my ignorance I had thought to be a giant porcelain cup. It made me blush all over my face and neck to think how ignorant I had been. In the morning Madame Albertine dressed and went down the stairs. There came the sounds of much commotion, many loud voices. From the window I saw Gaston the chauffeur putting a high polish on the big Renault car. Then he disappeared, to return shortly dressed in his best uniform. He drove up to the front entrance and servants loaded the luggage space with many cases and bundles. I crouched lower, Monsieur Leduc and me, to the car, entered, and were driven down the drive by Gaston. The noise below me increased, but this time the sound was as of people celebrating and came creaking and wheezing up the stairs, her face flushed with happiness and wine. "They have gone, little Fifi," she yelled, apparently thinking that I was deaf. "They have gone. For a whole week we are free from their tyranny. Now we have fun." Grasping me to her, she carried me down the stairs where a party was in progress. The servants all looked happier now, and I felt very proud that Madame Albertine was carrying me, although I feared that my weight of 4 pounds might tire her. For a week we all purred together. At the end of that week we straightened the place and put on our most miserable expression in preparation for the return of me. Diplomat and her husband. We did not bother at all about him. He usually walked around fingering the Legion of Honor button in his coat lapel. Anyway, he was always thinking of the service and countries, not of servants and cats. Me. Diplomat is the trouble. She was a virago indeed, and it was like a reprieve from the guillotine when we heard, on the Saturday, that they would be away for another week or two as they were meeting the best people. Time sped on. In the mornings I would help the gardeners by turning up a plant or two so that I might see if the roots were growing satisfactorily. In the afternoons I would retire to a comfortable branch on the old apple tree and dream of warmer climates and age-old temples where the yellow-robed priests moved silently around in pursuit of their religious offices. Then I would awaken suddenly to the sound of airplanes of the French Air Force roaring insanely across the sky. I was becoming heavy now, and my kittens were beginning to stir within me. Movement was not so easy, I had to pick my steps. For some days past I had been in the habit of going to the dairy and watching the milk from the cows being put into a thing which whirred and produced two streams, one of milk and one of cream. I sat upon a low shelf, out of everyone's way. The dairy maid would talk to me and I would answer her. One evening I was sitting on the shelf, about 6 feet from a half-full churn of milk. The dairy maid was talking to me about her latest boyfriend and I was purring to her, assuring her that everything would be all right between them. Suddenly there was an ear-splitting shriek, like a Tom with his tail stepped on me. Diplomat rushed into the dairy shouting, "I told you not to have cats in here, you will poison us." She picked up the first thing to hand, a copper measure, and flung it with all her strength at me. It caught me in the side most violently and knocked me off into the milk churn. The pain was terrible. I could hardly paddle to keep afloat. I felt my insides oozing out. The floor shook under heavy footsteps, and Madame Albertine appeared. Quickly she tipped the churn and poured out the blood-stained milk. Gently she placed her hands upon me. "Call Mr. the veterinarian," she commanded. I swooned off. When I awakened I was in Madame Albertine's bedroom, in a warmly lined box. 3 ribs were broken, and I had lost my kittens. For a time I was very ill indeed. Mr. the veterinarian came to see me often and I was told that he had said stern words to me. "Diplomat. Cruelty. Needless cruelty, he. People will not like it. People will say that you are a bad woman. The servants told me," he said, "that the little mother cat was very clean and very honest. No, me. Diplomat, it was very bad of you." Madame Albertine wet my lips with water, for I would turn pale at the thought of milk. Day after day she tried to persuade me to eat. Mr. the veterinarian said, "There is no hope now, she will die, she cannot live another day without food." I lapsed into a coma. From somewhere I seemed to hear the rustling of the trees, the creaking of branches. "Little cat," said the apple tree, "little cat, this is not the end. Do you remember what I told you, little cat?" Strange noises buzzed in my head. I saw a bright yellow light, saw wondrous pictures and smelled the pleasures of heaven. "Little cat," whispered the trees, "this is not the end. Eat, and live. Eat and live. This is not the end. You have a purpose in life, little cat. You shall end your days in joy, in the fullness of years. Not now. This is not the end." Wearily I opened my eyes and raised my head a trifle. Madame Albertine, with great tears streaming down her cheeks, knelt beside me, holding some finely sliced pieces of chicken. Mr. the veterinarian stood at a table filling a syringe from a bottle. Weakly I took a piece of chicken, held it in my mouth a moment, and swallowed it. "A miracle," said Madame Albertine, and turned, mouth agape, slowly put down the syringe and walked across to me. "It is, as you say, a miracle," he remarked. "I was filling the syringe in order to administer the coup de grace and thus save her any further suffering." Smiled up at them and gave 3 beats of purr, all that I could manage. As I slipped again into sleep I heard him say, "She will recover." Sorry state, I could not take a deep breath. Nor could I manage more than a few steps. Had brought my earth box very close, for mother had taught me to be scrupulously careful in my habits. About a week later, Madame Albertine carried me downstairs. I was standing at the entrance to a room looking stern and disapproving. "Must be taken to an outhouse, Albertine," said me. "Begging your pardon, ma'am," said Madame Albertine, "she is not yet well enough, and if she is badly treated I and other servants will leave." With a haughty sniff and stare, me turned on her heel and re-entered the room. In the kitchens, below stairs, some of the older women came to speak to me and told me they were glad I looked better. Ian gently put me on the floor so that I could move around and read all the news of things and people. I'm tired, for I was as yet far from well, and I went to Madame Albertine, looked up at her face, and told her I wanted to go to bed. Picked me up and carried me to the top of the house again. So tired that I was sound asleep before she laid me in my bed. Chapter 2. It is easy to be wise after the event. Writing a book brings back one's memories. Through years of hardship I often thought of the words of the old apple tree, "Little cat, this is not the end in life." Then I thought it was mainly a kindness to cheer me. Now I know better. In the evening of my life, I have much happiness. If I am absent for even a few moments I hear, "Where's Fife? Is she all right?" And I know that I am truly wanted for myself, not just for my appearance. In my young days it was different. I was merely a showpiece, or as modern people have it, a conversation piece. The Americans would call it a gimmick. It had two obsessions. She was obsessed with the idea that she should climb higher and ever higher in the social scale of France, and showing me off to people was a sure charm to success. It amazed me, because she hated cats, except in public, and I was not allowed in the house unless there were visitors. The memory of the first show off is vivid in my mind. I was in the garden on a warm, sunny day. I had been studying the flowers, watching the bees carry pollen on their legs. Moved on to examine the foot of a poplar tree. Neighbor's dog had recently been there and left a message which I wanted to read. Casting frequent glances over my shoulder to see that all was safe, I devoted my attention to the message. Gradually I became more and more interested and more withdrawn from the events around me. Unexpectedly, rough hands grabbed me and woke me from my contemplation of the dog message. PSSST, I hissed as I leapt free, giving a backwards swipe as I did so. Quickly I scrambled up the tree trunk and looked down. "Always run first and look afterwards," Mother had said. "It is better to run needlessly than to stop and never be able to run again." Down there was Pierre the gardener holding the end of his nose. A trickle of scarlet blood was leaking past his fingers. Looking at me with hate, he stooped, picked up a stone, and threw it with all his strength. I dodged round the trunk, but even so the vibration of the stone against the trunk almost shook me free. He bent to pick up another stone just as the bushes parted behind him and Madame Albertine, walking silently on the mossy ground, stepped through. Taking in the scene at a glance, she swiftly shot a foot forward, and Pierre fell face down onto the earth. She grabbed him by his collar and jerked him upright, shaking him violently. "He was just a little man," she swung him round. "You hurt that cat and I kill you. See, sent you to find her, you son of a pig." "Not hurt her." The cat jumped out of my hands and I fell against the tree and made my nose bleed, Pierre muttered. I lost my temper because of the pain. Shrugged and turned to me. "To Mama," she called. "I'm coming," I yelled as I put my arms round the tree trunk and slithered down backwards. "Now you be on your best behavior, little Fifi," said Madame Albertine. "The mistress wants to show you to her visitors." The term mistress always amused me. A Leduc had a mistress in Paris, so how was me mistress? However, I thought, if they want her to be called mistress as well, it will not hurt me. These were very strange and irrational people. We walked together across the lawn, Madame Albertine carrying me so that my feet should be clean for the visitors. Up the broad stone steps we went. I saw a mouse scurry into a hole by a bush, and across the balcony. The open doors of the salon I saw a crowd of people sitting and chattering like a flock of starlings. "Have brought Fifi, Madame." Mistress jumped to her feet and gingerly took me from my friend. "Oh my darling sweet little Fifi," exclaimed as she turned so quickly that I was made giddy. Women rose to their feet and crowded close, uttering exclamations of delight. Siamese cats were a rarity in France in those days. Even the men present moved to have a look. A black face and white body, ending with a black tail, seemed to intrigue them. "Rarest of the rare," said the mistress. "A wonderful pedigree, she cost a fortune. So affectionate, she sleeps with me at night." Held a protest at such lies, and everyone jumped back in alarm. "He is only talking," said Madame Albertine, who had been ordered to stay in the salon just in case. Like me, Madame Albertine's face was registering astonishment that the mistress should tell such absolute falsehoods. "Oh, Renée," said a woman visitor, "you should take her to America when you go. American women can very greatly assist your husband's career if they like you, and the little cat certainly draws attention. Pursed up her thin lips so that her mouth completely disappeared. Claire queried, "How would I do that?" "She would make trouble and then there would be difficulties when we brought her back." "Nonsense, Renee, I am surprised at you," replied her friend.